whether you believe your child comes fully formed, as in they are who they are, and that's my belief, is that they are like a whole little person with their own hopes, dreams, personality. And my job is to almost usher them through, helping them keep as much of that intact as I possibly can. I remember where I was, actually. I was sat by the pond in Clapham, where I used to live, when I was reflecting on this and writing about it and realizing it. And it was like a bit of a bombshell moment for me to see it that differently. And it takes pressure off.
It does, because your job is then to, well, what I say in the book is that you're holding them, not molding them. You know, you're sort of offering them that support through their own journey. You're not the one who is deciding that journey for them and ushering them into the direction that you choose for them. Of course, lots of parents do that. And it's interesting to see how children will respond differently to that. Some children will comply. Some children will push back. Sometimes they'll push back in very healthy ways. Sometimes they push back in ways that feel more destructive to the relationship. But children are very good at letting us know, actually, this is not who I am. This person that you are pushing me into, that is not who I am. As they grow, of course, what we know from attachment is that in order to stay close to us, which is essentially their number one safety behavior, they will then internalize some of those parts of them that feel less acceptable to us. So they learn that quite quickly.
Which goes back to what we were saying before. There's exactly those parts that come back in us.
Those are the parts that come back in us, the bits that have been pushed away, the bits that have felt unacceptable, the bits that, for whatever reason, we've tried to shut off. I mean, I find that it's a kind of fascinating and devastating concept all at the same time, right? The way that in order to make sure that children maintain closeness to us, they will take not only the parts of them that feel unacceptable, but they'll also internalize the parts of us that they feel are unacceptable, like the bits of us that aren't meeting their needs. It's a really interesting dynamic that occurs between a parent and a child, where if we're not meeting a child's needs for whatever reason, a child will not, and it's not a conscious thought, of course, but a child will not think, oh, my parent is incapable of meeting this need in me. They'll think there's something about me that means that my parent can't do that. So I must be bad or broken or flawed in some way. When we're able to articulate to our children, this is what is coming up for me, this is why I'm not meeting that need, in so many words, you know, actually, I'm really sorry that I shouted there, because I was shouted at a lot when I was a child, but that's not something that I want to be doing to you. And I am really trying to work on that. And, you know, how did that feel for you? So that you can repair those kind of inevitable ruptures or discords that happen, that allows the child to see that that is yours, it's not theirs. This is the second part of the book, or the second point, because the reason you asked me this at the beginning, how does it make us enjoy parenting more, is because not only are we bringing our whole selves then, and we're kind of accepting of all of those parts of us, it also means that we're not giving them to our children to deal with. Our children then are not carrying our burdens on our behalf, and then they can show up in our relationship as their whole selves too. You know, and of course, children are going to carry some of our burdens. Like, that is just part of parenting. We are not going to break every cycle. We are going to create our own problems. We are going to give them things that we wish we hadn't. Like, that is just an inevitability. But when we're able to talk about that and have those conversations, at some point they can say to us, do you know what? You can have this back because it's not mine. And that is such a gift to give to a child, or in any relationship. The acknowledgement and welcoming even the idea that you can take something back that you might have inadvertently handed over to them. Because then they get to embrace all of those parts of them. You know, they don't have to have so many, you know, exiled parts of them or the bits of them that they're pushing away, because they know, first of all, maybe not all of them belong to them, but also because they felt accepted, that those parts of them are acceptable, because it's okay to be flawed and messy and make mistakes.
I like the way you say that it's heartbreaking about the adaptations that we make. That's how I feel about it in a way. I just wish it wasn't, but it's so interesting, isn't it? That cycle. You know, if I think about my own self with this, you know, that part of me, once I understood that people pleasing part of me is just an adaptation that I made in order to keep my caregivers close, right? That's an adaptation that I made. And I think of it as like, You know, like those Russian dolls, there's the core me, and then I've layered on these things to help me stay close and to dance around the unwritten rules of my family growing up. Where it gets absolutely fascinating is just kind of what we've been talking about the whole conversation, is then that gets activated in any relationship, particularly in the relationship. And then I get to choose to, in a way, repeat that, right? Which would just be looking like people pleasing or not allowing my children to say what they want in that example I was given with Rose. Or because I've done a little bit of, like you say, that self-reflection, understanding myself, then I give myself a little bit of a chance not to do that, which is why in that interaction with Rose, I've got that little bit of spaciousness now where I can not leap into.
You sort of make a choice. It becomes more of a conscious choice. Yeah.
And I think that's the thing with what you're saying, and with my experience actually, of having that self acceptance, awareness, knowledge, whatever words we put to it, I think it gives you a choice. And without that, I don't think, you tell me, I don't think we have much of a choice, because we're just sort of unconsciously doing what we know what to do, right?
The reason that happens is because of our stress response, which is automatic. When you have any kind of unresolved childhood trauma, trauma can feel like a really big word. You know, it's just unresolved stuff, right? Stuff that kind of felt uncomfortable. Right, we've all got loads of baggage. So, you know, these kind of little wounds or little things that happen to us that we haven't necessarily really looked at, we know now, there's a lot written about this, that kind of lives on in our body. It lives on in an unconscious way. It lives on in our limbic system, in our brain, right? So that is our amygdala response, our survival mode, that stress response that comes up very automatically. When we're making conscious choices, that's because we're using our executive functioning, the frontal lobes of the brain. That's where we do our thinking, our reflecting, our rationalizing. That is the part of the brain that allows us to inhibit those impulses. So essentially, in those moments, if we're touched, if that stuff is touched in some way, that activates our limbic system, that activates our amygdala response. It tells our body in some way there is a threat. The threat might be to our ego. The threat might be to that little kid in us that we haven't really spoken to yet, you know, who's had experiences that get very touched by our parenting experiences in the moment. Essentially, that's what we're talking about, right? When we talk about triggers, we're talking about something's triggered our limbic system response, that kind of activation mode. What happens when we're in that survival state is that those frontal lobes just disappear. So we don't have a choice, because everything in our body is saying there's a threat and we need to respond to that to get us back to a place of safety. What we know is that safety just means familiarity. It might not necessarily be, this is what is actually going to make me feel safer in the moment. It's just, here I am on this very familiar loop that feels really comfortable to me because I've walked that path many times before. That's our amygdala hijack. Then we respond in a way that we don't necessarily want to. It's later on, when our frontal lobes come back online, that we just go, wow, what just happened? And then we might go back, process. And in that moment of processing is what kind of helps us get it out of our emotional brain, our limbic system, and into that more rational, conscious place. If we don't do that, then it remains in that amygdala response, in that very survival mode stress response. So that's kind of technically what's happening when we're exploring, when we're doing that self-reflection. We're taking that stuff out of the survival parts of our nervous system or the limbic system in our brain, and we're basically transporting them into our long-term memory stores. We can update them then. We can say, actually, I don't need to respond like that because I'm not a little girl anymore. Actually, now I'm an adult and this is how I want to respond. You know, we can use techniques that will help us to stay in our frontal lobes, to stay in that more rational, reasonable part of our brain. And those are the bits that help us respond with choice, with consciousness. It sounds really complicated. I'm talking about all of the way that the brain works and our kind of nervous system responses. Essentially, it's just about taking the automatic into something that feels conscious. And the only way we can do that is by looking at the stuff.